It's January 17th, 2000, and this is the second edition of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. This is where I, John Zogby, a longtime pollster, and my son Jeremy Zogby will take a look at issues that dominated the week in culture, politics, globally, whatever comes up. The uniqueness of this is that I'm a boomer in the mix, and I bring to this conversation the sensibility of not only someone who's been polling for 35 years, but comes from an age cohort known for our rebellion and for our challenging of traditions. And I'm here with my son, Jeremy, and he is the millennial in the mix. Hi, Jer.
Hey, Dad. Yeah, I'm the millennial in the mix. And what I bring to this conversation is the global background, given that millennials were the first generation to come of age with the internet and to take advantage of world travel. Let's start. Let's get right into it and pick up where we left off last week, because we covered a lot of big news and there have been some developments. So first things first, let's talk about Iowa. Let's talk about the Democratic presidential race. Where do things stand right now, especially after having the debate a couple nights ago?
Well, there's a brand new poll out today by our colleagues at Monmouth University, and that poll has Bernie Sanders back in the lead, but very close with Joe Biden. In third place, Pete Buttigieg. In fourth place is Elizabeth Warren, who has continued to suffer a little bit. This new poll is a tad different from the very respected Des Moines Register poll that came out a few days earlier, with Joe Biden actually in the lead. The first time that he's led in Iowa in actually quite a while. But the important thing is that the top four candidates, and of course those are Biden, Sanders, Warren, and Buttigieg, are more or less clustered at the top. And in a fifth place, but continuing to rise in both of these new polls, is Amy Klobuchar, who comes in at about 8% and is, you know, kind of on the heels of Elizabeth Warren, who's dropped into that fourth place. So there's a lot going on here with just a few weeks to go.
Sure. And what you make of the feud between Bernie and Elizabeth Warren? Of course, it's the talk of the town. Elizabeth Warren pulling back her hand to shake with Bernie after the debate. Some are talking about, especially within the progressive wing of the party, that people are nervous and that there could be some fallout. And in fact, David Axelrod said just a couple days ago that something along the lines of, if you antagonize the other person's supporters, it has a lasting impact on you, to the extent that there could be some division of the base, and that could be a benefit to others. How do you react to that?
Well, you know, the two are friends, and it's been documented, but then the two are also engaged in battle, in war. There can only really be one serious progressive that goes to the Democratic convention in July in Milwaukee. And so the stakes are extremely high, and it's not surprising then that even if the candidates had not expressed any ill feelings with each other, that the staffs would, because staffs want to win, and staffs sometimes can't even be controlled by the candidate. This looks like a private conversation that was held in late 2018. What was said or not said, I think really only two people know, Sanders and Warren. However, Warren's people decided to play the gender card this time around and decided that her chance to win was to rally women. And no better way, I suppose, they discovered to rally women than to say that our leading opponent on the progressive side is either misogynist or genuinely doesn't believe a woman can win. Obviously, Bernie Sanders, who does not have misogyny really anywhere in his DNA, let alone his resume, took umbrage with that. And there are some who are arguing, I happen to agree, that the CNN reporter was very unfair in this instance to Bernie Sanders, just assuming that that Elizabeth Warren's recollection as well as interpretation was that, that Bernie had said something negative. In the final analysis, it looks to me like Bernie was the one who was helped by this. Bernie is the one who has the ardent emotional supporters. They're not going anywhere. Parallel that to Trump supporters. You know, Bernie is loved by his supporters, and if anything, they'll work even harder, give even a little bit more, and come out to vote. The polls, I think, are showing that in Iowa as well as New Hampshire, Elizabeth Warren has taken a hit from this entire dust up.
You often talk about back in 2004, leading up to the Iowa caucus, that Howard Dean was leading the polls, and mm-hmm. he looked like almost the guaranteed winner. But as you were tracking the lead up to the Iowa caucus, John Kerry was moving up. And mm-hmm. of course, there are a lot who think that Dean, who was, I don't know if he was hot mic'd or whatever, but the microphone was on and he was screaming. And then within a day or two, his poll numbers dropped. But you have always maintained that he was on the downfall anyway, that he had reached his mm-hmm. peak. And so if we can look at that event and use that, if we can, to try and project what could happen in 2020, does that analogy offer any insight as to what can happen after Iowa?
You know, it sure does. I don't know if it'll replay, but it does show that anything can happen in the last few weeks. Either there's some sort of external event or some sort of movement by another candidate. So let's pick up where we left off with the Warren-Sanders dispute. So suppose Elizabeth Warren takes a little bit of heat 48, 72 hours after the last debate, but this becomes a rallying cry for women. And women who may have been supporting Pete Buttigieg or Amy Klobuchar or any one of the other candidates decide, hey, this is the last shot we have in our lifetime to nominate a woman. I'm going to go with Elizabeth Warren. Maybe some evidence of that, too, anecdotally, though it's not showing up in the polls. That could be a situation where we watch in daily tracking polls that Warren actually does go up. And then some of the lesser candidates go down, perhaps a little bit taken off of Joe Biden. I don't think any support will be lost by Bernie Sanders. The polls show that his voters, his supporters, are the most intense. But when we report our Zogby report, we stick in terms of the numbers to what's going on today and this week, let alone try to project what may happen in a few weeks. But as of this moment, Sanders is in the lead, very close to the lead if you average the polls, and so is Joe Biden. And I would say that that's what it's going to look like to me in the end, but still a little too early.
Does that mean that you think in the end that, as things are tracking right now, it looks to be that Bernie Sanders is the unifier of the party?
That's a strong one. Bernie has his enemies within the party. There are two groups. Among Democrats, there are the ideological members of the establishment who fear that Bernie's a socialist, and that Bernie would be bad for the country and bad for the Democratic Party. By the same token, there are those that really fear defeat, and the stakes are very high. What you're hearing over and over again was, we can survive 4 years of Donald Trump. We're not sure we can survive 8 years of Donald Trump. And they fear that Bernie would lead the party in a similar fashion to the way that George McGovern did in 1972, losing almost every state. And so to call him the unifier, I think, might be strong, but he could still win the nomination by winning the primaries and caucuses.
Now, changing gears, and again, picking up on last week, as far as what's going on in Iran, what are you reading about? There have been a lot of developments in just 7 days since we launched our episode one of our podcast. So what have you, what's caught your attention in the last week as far as developing stories?
There are a number of conflicting signals. So for starters, we did have street demonstrations going on in Iraq, mainly young people, very similar in many ways to what we're seeing all around the world. But in particular, these were people who were somewhat enamored with the United States, with Western values, are disgusted with the regime, both in terms of the values it represents, but also in particular the economy and the fact that the economy has been terribly squeezed and is very expensive and offers very little hope for young people. And so they were actually marching against the regime. And then Donald Trump launched the attack against Soleimani, you know, a hated figure among these protesters, a leader of terrorist actions. But it was the United States that unilaterally decided to kill this terrorist. And you started to see some of the, or many of the protesters on the ground laying off the regime and starting to rally actually around the regime against an attack by the United States. But after a few days, that dissipated. And you then had the Ayatollah himself do something very rare, and that is offer a public sermon in which he protested the United States once again as the devil, the aggressor, the colonizer. And this was an overt effort on his part to win over the protesters and to save his regime. Now, we're at a point, he's at a point where his regime is in real trouble. And in many ways, just like 40 some odd years ago with the Ayatollah Khomeini, it's a question as to who's going to control these folks out in the streets. Is it going to be the Ayatollah and his mullahs, or is it going to be a democratic revolution as we almost had in 2009? And it's at a very tender moment right now.
And of course, to the west in Iraq, the parliament has voted to basically ask the United States military to leave, to get out of the region. And yeah, there are all kinds of, you know, implications for that. If I were to understand that, of course, we have to put this in the context of a 17-year-long war in Iraq, and then not too far away, a 19-year-long war in Afghanistan, that it seems to be consensus within the United States is that these haven't brought much fruit for the American people. And a lot of people in this country are questioning why this long. It opens the door for other powers to broker peace in the Middle Eastern region. And actually, there's an interesting story developing, and oilprice.com reports that Beijing has had successful talks with Iraq in starting an agreement for exporting 100,000 barrels per day of crude oil to China over a 20-year period. I guess my question is this the beginning of the end for the United States in the Middle East region? And is the Middle Eastern region going to look to other powers to start brokering peace and economic infrastructure development deals?
Very good question, and Jarrett's a very good analysis, because Beijing has been making its move worldwide now for a number of years. We see it in Latin America, certainly see it in Africa, other parts of Asia. You're seeing it with the new Silk Road efforts, linking it to Eurasia and to Europe as well. Middle East, of course, is vital. And we have two things going on. One is not simply the beginning of the decline, maybe the middle part of the decline of American influence in the Middle East. Our dependence has mainly been on oil. We're less dependent on that. By the same token, we've made some serious errors, as you've pointed out. Iraq was a serious error. All we did was replace a Sunni minority leadership class with a radical, to a great degree, Shia majority in power, and we've left Iraq in worse shape than it was under the barbaric Saddam Hussein. In Afghanistan, the only way the United States leaves is to negotiate with the Taliban. Well, my God, we went in there to, as the Russians did too, for that matter, even before, to destroy the Taliban, and they it can't be destroyed. And so these wars are more than symbolic. I mean, they are actually endemic of the failure of a colonizing power, the failure of an imperial power to dictate in the Middle East. And yeah, even now with Iran, what we're seeing is that members of the coalition with us that had once supported the nuclear deal in Iran are looking for ways to sidestep the United States, to sidestep sanctions, and to actually participate in the parts where they can of that nuclear deal with Iran. And so, yeah, the United States is seriously losing its authority in the region.
And we also discussed last week around the globe what is happening. Of course, we talked about all the protests. 2019 was certainly a year of protests around the world, and 2020 mm-hmm. is already looking to be more so. In fact, there's a consulting firm by the name of Verisk Maplecroft. That's quite a name. And they pointed out that in 2019, you had 47 nations around the globe that faced civil unrest. And mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what their methodology is, but they're projecting that 40% of the total nations, that's 40% of 190 nations around the world, which would be 75 nations, will experience civil unrest this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's also based on something that you and I have been talking about and speaking about publicly. That is, number one, you have not only youth rebellion, a youth explosion. Such a huge percentage of the world's population, especially in developing countries, that are growing, exploding in numbers. More educated than ever before, more urban than ever before, more connected with each other within countries and globally with other similar thinking people who actually are financially better off than they were before. It's a period of rising expectations at the same time that the world economy, a little sluggish, but still has continued to grow, and young people are demanding more. They're demanding more from government. They're demanding more on the world stage. And they're finding that the political and governing institutions are just not in a position to react and react quickly with decisions as they ever have before. So there's a huge demand for change. I'm really oversimplifying here, but it's not surprising. This is all part of an ongoing revolution that's been taking place, and it's been enabled by technology.
Yeah, and you know, back in December, you and I were invited to AARP to talk about, and actually the title of the afternoon panel was "What on Earth is Going On?" And I talked about, and this seems to fit in exactly with what you just analyzed and broke down there, but I talked about how a regime that is a system of governance flowing from the top down usually has a shelf life of about 70 years. The reason mm-hmm. being that since a generation is about 20 years, by the time you get to the third generation, they are so far removed from the original principles that mm-hmm. encapsulated the regime. And so no question about it, what has been the regime around the world? It's been the post-war American regime. 1945, it was established, and it had influenced so much of the structures and the institutions that we've come to know that have such a powerful influence in the world, whether it's the United Nations, it's the IMF or the World Bank, and not just these global institutions, but the post-war American regime has also influenced other governments around the world. And so here we are in 2020, and it's been 75 years. And so It looks to be exactly what you're saying. This third generation and fourth, which would be Gen Z, alongside millennials, out in the streets, no longer relating to the system. And so, well, there's an old saying, may you live in interesting times, and we are certainly living in interesting times. Right, Boomer?
Yes, yes, sir, millennial. And let me just take this opportunity to say that we're very fortunate that we're going to be tracking these interesting times. Next week's podcast on Friday, we will feature the results of two separate polls of 18 to 29-year-olds, one that we conducted for the U.S. Conference of Mayors, a longtime client of ours that'll be released, and the other for Forbes, taking a look at, again, politics and culture and what makes younger millennials and Gen Z tick, what makes them different from others. So we'll be continuing with the themes, but we'll have some great numbers to share.
We look forward to it. Thank you for joining us again in episode 2. We'll see you in next week in episode 3.
Bye-bye.